us a couple house files. The first house file that we're going to discuss, or at least hear information about, is House File 1067, and that is a bill carried by Representative Sikora. That is going to be an informational hearing at this point. We will not be voting on that bill. As you know, we have a process for licensing bills and registration bills and such, but I think it's very important that we hear about this bill. And I don't know if any of you, but I certainly have gotten many, many letters over the summer and even during the last session on this particular issue. So I think it would be helpful to hear the dilemma that the surgical assistants are in at this point. Before we get to that, and Representative Sikora, if you'd like to bring your proponents with you to the table and get prepared. Before we do that, I also like to mention that we're going to also take up House File 2085, as you can see from the agenda. Then following that, we will be getting to House File 1681. While it may not be possible to complete all of our work in this committee hearing, we will be here until 2:15, and after that we will come back a half an hour after session, should that be necessary, I believe in this very same room.
Is that correct?
In this room, room 10. So at this point, Representative Towle moves adoption of the minutes from the Wednesday, February 11th meeting. All those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Are there any questions as far as the process today? Okay. Seeing none, then Representative Sikora, would you please proceed with the information on this bill?
Thank you, Chair Boudreau, and thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to bring an issue forward that I think is rather important. Never in my 10 years here have I brought a licensing bill before this committee, and it isn't something I would have expected to do, but learning more about this issue, it seemed to me that it was something that needed to be addressed, and I guess it's up to you to decide how this should be addressed, but it's definitely a problem area. My bill, which has, by the way, and I know you're not hearing the bill, but there's a delete everything amendment. And the delete everything amendment would provide registration for surgical assistance. I think that the way this is going with surgery, hospitals, etc., it's going to end up costing us a lot more money than what we have been doing with surgical assistance in the past. But I have a couple of witnesses here who I think will do a very good job of explaining it. And first I have Bruce Hertzenberg, who is a surgical assistant, and he happens also to be one of my constituents. And then I have a Dr. Saylor, who is a surgeon, and he is going to talk about what's going on and why we need something like this to happen. We also have available, if there are questions, Dick Auld from the Board of Medical Practices, who is supportive of this issue, and that's only if there are questions for him. We'll try to keep our testimony somewhat brief.
And so, Representative Sikora, I believe, you know, we do have a PowerPoint presentation, but members, in case that isn't fully on the screen, you have one in your packet. It's very easy to read. And as far as discussion on this bill, we would be referring to the delete all amendment as far as questions that you may wish to ask.
Right.
Please proceed.
Mr. Hertzenberg.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name. All of the people who testify today, please state your name for the tape. We are recording this.
Oh, good. Good afternoon. My name is Bruce Hertzenberg, and I am a surgical first assistant certified, and I specialize in neurosurgery, and I have privileges at 14 of the metro hospitals. Thank you very much for granting us this hearing today. And we're here to testify the House Bill number HF 1067, State Registration for Surgical Assistance. This is a very important bill affecting not only us as surgical assistants, but surgeons, hospitals, and most importantly, the patients. This bill will help assure patient safety, create standards for surgical assistance, and assure us reimbursement from the insurance companies for our work. I prepared a PowerPoint presentation to inform you why it's so important for you to pass this bill. But before we begin, I just need to define a couple of terms. First of all, there are three main professions that fulfill the role of assistant in surgery. There are physician assistants certified, or PACs, registered nurse first assistants, and certified first assistant, certified surgical assistant. All these acronyms can be very confusing. The certified first assistant and the certified surgical assistants are trained, certified surgical technicians that have furthered their education and experience, fulfilled the certified first assistant, certified surgical assistant's eligibility requirements, and passed the national certification test. Both the CFA and CSA credential are recognized by the Federal Commission on Accreditation of Allied Health Education Programs. All three professions are considered allied health professionals. Please, if there are any questions during this presentation, feel free to interrupt me. The need for professional registration of surgical assistants in Minnesota. Okay. Oops, I went by one. We can all read this, I'm sure. Would you like me to read it out loud, or can we just go through and...
Well, Mr. Hertzenberg, if you can help us kind of get... we're going to investigate this deeper in a subcommittee. Mm-hmm. And so if you can kind of give us the general flavor of the need and some of the issues that surround it, kind of the more the executive summary, mm-hmm. Well, that would keep our attention and probably help advance your cause.
just go through this. I'll go through it quickly.
Please, Mr. Hertzenberg, proceed.
Background, we've been working with the Minnesota Surgeons for over 50 years. This is what we do in the operating room. And as defined by the American College of Surgeons, this is our job description. Is there some of the things we need to know to be this to be in this profession? The important points are to protect patients. These are some of the reasons that are ways that we protect the patient. This is one very important part that I want to stop and mention. Surgical assistants, and most surgeons will back me up when I say that a good first assistant or surgical assistant will save anywhere from half an hour to an hour on a procedure, depending on the procedure. These are some ways that we help Minnesota hospitals. According to the Twin Cities Hospital magazine, 16 operating room costs $16.66 a minute. And by saving 5 minutes, it can save $83.33. And if you multiply that times 65 surgical procedures a day, and this is in one metro hospital, Abbott Northwestern does over 100 operations a day. If you want to do the math, it comes out saving over $1 million a year just by saving 5 minutes in the operating room. Currently, most of the insurance companies don't recognize surgical assistants, mainly because they base their policies on Medicare policies. And Medicare policies don't recognize us because we're not state recognized or state regulated. And so, therefore, they have decided that they're not going to pay us. The Medicare, the federal government has come out with a Federal General Accounting Office report stating, and I put this in all of the packets, the need to relook this item up in the Medicare policies, and it needs a change. The most important part of that whole report is the Appendix 2, which is Medicare, the head of Medicare writing a letter back to the GAO office stating their points of view, and I think that is something that needs to be noticed. The insurance companies have actually stopped reimbursing CSAs or surgical assistants. We are doing a lot of the surgery these days every day, either for nothing or for a small amount of money. That is why this is so important that this bill pass.
Mr. Hertzenberg, maybe you can just clarify that point, and then I'll help you along to triage your presentation here. When you say you're not getting paid, you mean you're not a volunteer?
Insurance companies are not reimbursing the surgeons whom we work for.
Mr. Hertzenberg, so are you a salary then at the hospital, and you were getting that level?
Not necessarily.
Okay, just have to wait till I stop, because we're on a tape here. And so can you maybe... it sounds like this is a reimbursement issue.
No.
And if you
not,
declare...
It's not just... I'm sorry. It's not just a reimbursement issue. It's a patient safety issue, and it's also a standards issue.
Okay. Just so you understand, this committee and the subcommittee will make a decision upon what's the problem, why would licensure make a difference for the people who practice the various service that would be practiced and for the people who receive the service. So those are kind of the key elements that, if you could focus on those, that would help us greatly today. So you're doing fine, but just okay.
The standards, et cetera, will go right through that. That's all in your packets. There's approximately 200 surgical assistants in Minnesota. About 125 have sought voluntary certification. The different states that are now working on, that have or are working on a license or registration bill. If we do not get registration, these are some of the reasons that we need to get this registration through. And these are the reasons also that we need to get this policy passed. Registration means establishing appropriate levels of regulatory standards to ensure patient safety in the operating room. These days, maybe Dr. Saylor can go into this a little bit more, but there really is no standard, national standard or state standard, who operates with the surgeon. It's the surgeon's decision who operates, and sometimes it's left up to who's available to assist during a certain procedure. That pretty well covers the PowerPoint. Is there any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hertzenberg, and Representative Scott, do you have more testifiers that would like to testify?
Yes, I'd like Dr. Saylor, who is a surgeon, to testify and take questions also.
Okay, so let's complete your testimony so you can present your package that you have, and then we'll take some questions if that's acceptable, Representative Scott. Please proceed. Identify yourself with the tape, and then please.
Good afternoon. My name is H.L. Saylor. I've been practicing general, peripheral vascular, and thoracic surgery in the Twin Cities for the last 22 years, and I did my training down in the Mayo Clinic. And if you ask my wife, she'll tell you that I live in the operating room, so that's where my life is. And it's a little bit hard to explain to you all, because you haven't been in the operating room more than likely, either helping with surgery or doing an operation. But an operation, you can think of as almost like a dance. Or maybe since we're in Minnesota, it's like a pair skating competition. If everybody knows the steps and they know what the program's all about, then it goes very smoothly and patients do very well. It's when you find those little nuances during the performance where you might have a fall that things don't work out so well. The surgical techs have been trained to have the operating room be their home. That's where they live also. They know sterile technique. They know how to handle instruments. They know how to handle the tissue. When you operate on somebody, all the tissues are not all the same. It's not like working on a car where you take a wrench and you can, you know, do the nuts and bolts. Arteries handle different than lungs. Lungs handle different than stomachs. And it's very important that the appropriate tension is put on the appropriate tissues. And I think that surgical technicians, because they're trained to be in the operating room all the time, have the best knowledge of this. When I trained down at the Mayo Clinic, I came in as an MD into my residency. They had surgical technicians, and we spent 2 years learning to become a surgical technician before they really let us do any operating. So we could see how to handle the tissue. And we could see, you know, what you could do and what you shouldn't be doing. So to me, the reason to make this a registered profession is so that they can get reimbursed and we can use surgical technicians in operating rooms as opposed to other people. I've operated with nurse practitioners. I've operated with physician's assistants. I've operated with RNs. None of those people live in the operating room. That's not how they're trained. It's not that they're not intelligent, and it's not that they don't know exactly what they're doing. But an operation is a different thing than just working in a hospital and taking care of patients. I remember during one of my rotations at the Mayo Clinic, I spent 3 months with a physician, and I went to review what he'd written about me, and in my file he wrote 2 words, good hands. That was it. You know, and I thought about that, and that was probably the highest compliment he could have given me as a resident. Because it is. It's about your hands. Not everybody has the same dexterity or ability to do things with their hands, eye-hand coordination, judgment, and the likes. But I think the people that work in the operating room all the time, and that's what their job is, do a much better job than people that are necessarily taking care of patients on the floor or doing physical examinations. And those people are already licensed or registered, and they're getting paid. So when I may have a physician's assistant helping me that's not familiar with the operating room, it will certainly take me more than a half an hour longer to do a procedure. But if it's a complicated procedure, it might take me an hour longer. And you know what? I'll be frustrated. And I don't think any of you would want to be operated on by somebody that's frustrated. Because if every time you have to say, okay, pick up that with your right hand, hold it there, and then I get to do my thing, and then, okay, now with your left hand, do this. And it almost comes down to that. I'm being totally serious here. And it's interesting to listen to some of the testimony here, because whenever they say it's not about the money, it's about the money. And so I know that that's kind of what you're thinking. You know, how much is this going to cost us to have these people in the operating room? I personally think that you're going to save a lot of money. Because what's happening in my practice, because we can't really afford to pay surgical techs a salary when we can get no reimbursement for them, we're going to physician's assistants. And we're hiring the best people that we can. And some of those people are very good, but their programs do not train them in the operating room the way surgical techs are. So it's going to take us a year at least to train our physician's assistants. And you're going to burn up a lot of money while we're training them, because it's going to take a lot longer to do procedures with new people that are not used to being in the operating room. You have to teach them sterile technique, how to handle the tissues, what the instrumentation is. It's really a big deal. So to me it's not a little thing here. It's not about the money. It's about patient safety, and it's about the quality of operation that you will get if you have the appropriate people helping with surgery.
Thank you, Doctor. Do you have any other testifiers up, Sakura?
No, Mr. Chair.
Well, members, let's do a few questions. I think that you're here presenting a situation that needs some attention is your testimony, and I think members have a few questions, and then we'll take a few questions, and so you can think you've had a chance to express yourself, and then we'll refer it down to the subcommittee is what I understand. I have a couple questions, though, if you would.
Well, Mr. Chair, there was one other issue raised, and I received, because I dropped this bill in last year, and we didn't have a hearing last year. So I had lots of letters, and, you know, one of the other issues that was raised, that there are occasions now where there are two surgeons performing a surgery, so we're paying two surgeons instead of a surgeon and a technical assistant or a surgeon's assistant, which I think is certainly a direction we don't want to go, that we would be paying two highly trained surgeons to do what normally one surgeon and one assistant would be doing.
Rep. Sikora, is it, doctor, are you from a hospital or a surgical center, or where do you do your practice?
I'm in a practice of nine surgeons. We work at Abbott Northwestern, North Memorial, Fairview Southdale, Fairview Ridges Hospital. So we work at four different hospitals. But probably 90% of my work is done at Southdale Hospital.
Okay.
But I go to all other hospitals.
Rep. Sikora, just for your information, I think that to properly hear this, these thoughts that are expressed, and I assume that they're true, they would be very controversial in some of the assertions that we're not using proper assistance and so on, and there that the people have some skill issues, and so that would be controversial. I think we want to have the time to explore that and let all sides present their points and to see if this is indeed the solution that is just in terms of time. We could spend the entire session on this topic hearing from people who have an alternative view or are surprised at that or something. So if you would accepts a few questions, that we'd like to do those, and then thank you for your coming. Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anyone can answer this one. You're looking for registration, then why are you not looking for licensure? Or is that part of it, or would that be the next step?
Representative Sikora, or your team?
In consultation with Mr. Ault, who's head of Board of Medical Practices, he said registration would be the proper thing, not licensure. So just to have a registration would be the right way to go. And so there was general agreement on that. So we changed the bill, which is why you have a delete everything amendment. Essentially, it was changed from licensure to registration.
Representative Sanderson.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'll do it for now.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, first of all, thanks for all you do. It kind of would gross me out to have to do all that stuff, so I'm glad you're there, and I'm not. But I want to address kind of two different categories of questions. First, on the safety side, how many unqualified assistants are out there right now? What's the scope of the problem? What and can you talk about some examples of how it's been dangerous and the problems that it has caused?
Doctor.
Well, I think that I don't know if it's fair to say that they're unqualified. I think it's fair to say that they're not educated in how the operating room necessarily works. And so people get trained in to do these jobs. And that and some people have difficulty getting that training. And so there are people out there that don't really do a very good job with sterile technique. And there are people that are not built to be in operating rooms. But that's what their job is. I mean, they just don't handle the tissue appropriately, and those people get weeded out. But it doesn't. They don't get weeded out in the course of a day or a week. It may take 6 months or a year. And I think that the surgeons are always in charge of the operations. I don't think people get bad operations because of this. They certainly get a prolonged operation and a frustrated operation, and the problems are with sterile technique and other things. If you're using certain types of sterile equipment and it gets contaminated and you still need that for the rest of the case, that all has to go out. You got to find some more that is sterile, or you have to re-sterilize that, and you're just sitting there waiting for that to come back. So I don't want to say that it's they're unqualified, but they're not. There are different levels. It's just like one of my partners will say that if you ask 100 surgeons how they are, they'll all tell you above average. And that's just statistically not possible. There are people that are better at their job and people that are not quite as good at their job. And when you find the ones that are really good at their job at this level, it's a real find, and you really save a lot of time.
Representative Wilkin.
Well, I guess I'm not seeing how being licensed or registered is gonna solve that. It sounds like you could just as easily accomplish what you need to do with more careful hiring and the physician and the practice group taking charge of what the qualifications of the people are who you're hiring. So I'm not convinced on kind of the patient safety. I don't think the case has been made. And I'm not going to belabor it because we'll probably see it in...
Can I make a quick comment?
No.
let me throw out another question, then you can comment on all the things. I don't understand how people could be working in this profession uncompensated for all this time. To me, it's the physician, it's the practice group's responsibility to compensate them. The only thing this would accomplish, the bill would accomplish, is to add additional billing to insurance costs, additional administrative costs. The cost should be built into the surgical charge, just like for any other allied health professional who is involved in the surgery. It's already being billed. It's just a matter of additional billing, it sounds like to me. And if the physician groups aren't doing the compensation, that's a matter between private parties, and I don't know that the legislature needs to be involved in it. Question and comment.
That's fine. I think we'll defer the response now. You can kind of see you have a little education to do on a number of sides here. Right. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Saylor, just so I'm straight on this, some surgeons now are replacing surgical assistants that aren't being compensated by physician's assistants, as you say. Now, are those physician's assistants, are they in an area, they registered where they can be compensated for your group, for instance, if you were to use PAs? Would you be compensated for that?
Yes.
Doctor, you have to just wait for me, but there's 100 questions we could ask today. I didn't mean to cut you off with your answer. I just don't know how far we can go into some of the discussion. So you're free to respond, but I apologize if I seem rude to you. So please, you may respond.
Mr. Chairman.
Pardon me?
Before you speak,
you should
say Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
You answer the question.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not sure exactly how you appropriately run the meeting, but Mr. Chairman, may I answer this question? Or
if you would, please. I was talking about before. If we have the opponents to your bill come forward, at least those talking about some of the policy issues you've raised, talking about the practice of surgery in hospitals, it would be a very long meeting to hear everybody properly. And so, and that's part of the premise for your need for licensure. And so, we're going to deal with that a different day. And so, I can just see some of the people in the back of the room with concerns on their faces as they see some of the things you've talked about. So I'm just trying to limit us to a finite, so we can kind of explore a few of the issues that will be before us as we properly treat this bill. So that's all. So if you'd like to respond to Representative Powell, that would be great now.
Okay. In our practice, we are replacing our surgical technicians who we used to pay out of our pockets with physician's assistants because we'll get reimbursed. If you want to talk about reimbursement for physician's fees, you can look at my fees. My fees have been reduced 40% over the last 5 years by the health plans and by Medicare. And we can no longer, we can't financially pay people for not getting some reimbursement for the work that they do. So that's what's happening. That's why people are no longer being paid. Now you might say, well, you should just still pay them. But we've been ground down to a level where we can't really afford to pay people to help us in the operating room if they're not getting paid also some amount.
Thank you. Representative Danielson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to compliment you folks on what you actually do. I think that's very important to our whole system. But I have a little question on the certification exam. Apparently, there's a national exam that's for certification. Now, with this type of certification and with somebody passing that exam, is there any way that the insurance companies could be spoke with or that you could make this more formal without having to go for registration?
Mr. Hertzberg.
May I answer that?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have gone to the insurance companies personally myself and they tell me that my wages are being paid to the hospitals in a bundled fee.
Okay.
The hospitals that I work at do not agree with that, of course, and those monies get tied up in all these, in this bundling.
Right.
It's a hot potato right now. Who's going to pay who? And it'll only get worse as time goes on because of the economy. But this is something very important for the patients. We all have families that eventually will end up in the operating room, and you want the best people there. And I think that we need to be paid for what we do.
Thank you. Any other members have questions? Mr. Hitzenberg and Dr. and Dr. Saylor and Upson Sikora, let me express, I'm a co-author on your bill. And I think as you bring forward the need for the bill, if one of the assertions is that there's some poor procedures done in operating rooms that are driving the need for this, that's actually a kind of a glaring statement that needs to be supported and will be debated by people who own operating rooms and who run hospitals and so on, and that will take some time. I support your work toward raising the standard of care, and that's why I'm a co-author on the bill. But I think as you proceed this bill, you're going to have to, that'll be a discussion item that'll be, I think, rather lengthy in the subcommittee when we get to there, just to help you out with that. And the reimbursement structures will be necessary for us to see that, so we can see how it's bundled and what it's expected to be covered, and so how licensure will save that, and if it will be a cost driver or a cost saver, if the issues of timing are going to save enough money to, if there's any cost increase, if it'll actually be a net savings, and so on. So that's my interest in this, as you bring forward your case. So do you want to summarize with any?
Mr. Chairman, I think the what I see as the major cost-saving issue is the fact that, as he said, every minute in the operating room costs a lot of money, and some surgeries are taking a lot longer because you don't have people who really know what they're doing or have the training or the experience to be doing the assisting. So when he's got to stop and say, well, would you pick up that and clamp that blood vessel or whatever the case may be, that's something that automatically most surgical assistants would know they have to do that. That would be how they work as a team. So I'm saying this was a very costly thing that we're doing here because we're paying a lot more time for not just the surgeon's time or the physician assistant's time, but the operating room time, which is kind of at a premium and something that we don't have an overabundance of. So it's one of the things that I think is an important feature, and I'm always concerned about costs in our healthcare system.
Well, thank you. And Representative Sikora, perhaps it would make sense for us to, if I move your bill, just to be before us and then move the deleted amendments, at least the bill is in the order you'd like as it progresses through the system. Would that be helpful to you?
Whatever you think is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Well, then it would at least be in the order that people can talk about it so what you've intended to bring forward can be seen by all and they can react to you. So, members, I'll move the House file.
Okay.
Well, first I move the file. What number is it? I'd like to move House File 1067 to be before us, and then I would move the delete all to put it in the shape the author would like. Any discussion about that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so at least you have the bill now in the way you would like to talk about it. And I do want to thank you for coming.
May Dr. Saylor make one more comment? He feels that he was kind of misunderstood. He'd just like to clarify something.
Please, Dr. Saylor, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think anybody in the Twin Cities, we have great medical care. I don't think anybody gets bad operations. And I think that you misinterpret how I feel about who's helping you with an operation, how the operation goes. The operations are prolonged because we don't get the same type of assistance with one, depending on who's helping us. Longer anesthetic time means it's longer for the patient to wake up from the surgery, and they have, it's just a longer deal for the patient. It's not as good to have the patient undergo 4 hours of anesthesia instead of 3 hours of anesthesia. So it's not about getting a bad operation. You might grade them as you get an A, B, or a C. You know, you might get a C with one person, you might get an A with another just based on anesthetic time or something like that. But I don't think that we're having a malpractice issue or I think bad maybe is the wrong term to think of it in those terms. But there are effects of anesthesia depending on how long the case goes, and I think that has to that goes into patient safety and how they do afterwards. Thank you.
I appreciate it, and thank you for coming, and I think you'll be interested in the discussion that this bill has will provoke in the next couple of days. So thank you for coming forward. Thanks
thank
for visiting
Mr.
us
Chairman
today.
Members.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Stevenson, you have your group here. Mr. Gibbs, amendments, Representative Stevenson, Paige will pass them out, I guess.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've got the amendment to the bill.
And do you have witnesses? And do you have witnesses with you?
Mr. Chair, I have a few people who can come up and testify, but I think in order to try and keep this as brief as possible, I think I'll reserve that unless we have some questions here.
I'll move your bill, and then you have an amendment as well, correct, to put it in the order you'd like?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to move House File 208, and I'd like to move amendment, this A048-0875.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's
put
correct.
Order you'd like.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think you said House File 208?
2085, sir.
Excuse me, 2085, I'm sorry. I'd like to move the amendment to put in order the author would like. Any discussion about that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. I was here a year ago, and we had a study bill that was dealing with a hospital study bill for the moratorium that was instituted in 1983. That bill was passed through committee, went on to finance, passed through finance, was placed into the omnibus bill, and then died in committee. This is not a study bill. This bill gives us the ability through the Department of Health to allow entities that are requesting exemption to that moratorium to move forward with a recommendation through the Department of Health. Specifically, this bill enables an entity to submit and fund a request for that exemption, and it also enables the Department of Health to collect the funds necessary to recover the costs for that request. The bill provides the Department of Health the avenue to investigate the exemption request, determine if the request is in the public good, provide objective findings, and present those findings to the legislature. This bill does not take away authority from the legislature to approve or disapprove the exemption process, and requires no additional funding from the Department of Health. And that's kind of putting it into a nutshell, and I won't go any further but to say if you have any specific questions, I would be happy to answer those and call forth any people to testify that you might want.
I think I just have a technical thing. I think I moved the wrong number. I think it was 0865, so I apologize. Which is that the correct one? Oh, was that right the first one? Okay, never mind. Members, have questions for Representative Stevenson? Representative Tao, do you have a question for Representative Stevenson? No, you're fully informed.
Easy crap. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Tell us why we're doing this again.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, in 1983, a moratorium was placed upon the hospital studies, and that was due. So what's taken place is, in order for a hospital to be instituted, or a review of those processes, it needs to be approved through the legislature. The legislature really has no means to find the facts in this issue, and this is what this bill is, to put together a process for the Department of Health to actually do the study, collect the funds that are required for the study through the requesting entity, and then come up with the findings with a recommendation to the legislature. Not necessarily a recommendation, but a disclosure of the findings from the study.
Representative Pima.
So if the Department of Health concludes that they don't think that an expansion should occur, is there still a way to bring that matter to the legislature, or is that it?
Representative Stevenson.
Through this
Mr. Chair, Representative Pima. No, the Department of Health merely brings the findings of their study to the legislature, and I don't know that. And in those findings, it should be investigate the determine if it's in the public good, and to bring the findings of that research to the legislature. And I would say probably in some instances there may be a recommendation, but that's not necessarily true. It does not mean that if they don't recommend it or the findings are not in favor of it, that that's where it stops. They still have the option. The legislature has the option of making up their own mind on this.
Representative Piemar?
Maybe it's in the delete all. I'm just looking at page 2. It talks about that the commissioner shall provide a copy of the determination, so it seems like they're making a determination to the chairs of the House and Senate committees having jurisdiction over health and human services policy and finance. So it doesn't really say, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, that it's the matter is brought back to the legislature, but rather back to the chairs of the two committees.
Mr. Chair, Representative Piemar, I would say that the avenue is such that they will come to committee. The recommendation or the findings will come to the committee. The committee will then have the opportunity to approve or disapprove and pass down the floor for discussion.
Representative Piemar?
Well, that's you're saying you're assuming that that's the case. That's not what the bill says.
Mr. Chair, could I
do a call a friend?
Great, thank you, friend. Hospital Association.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing Minnesota's 139 hospitals. The moratorium law stays in place, and the legislature maintains its authority. This is a fact-finding or gathering of information done by the third party at the Department of Health. So the moratorium law stays on the books. An entity can still come forward and present its case to the legislature and still move forward with a moratorium project. The difference is that does the legislature have information that has evaluated this project outside of perhaps the pressures of the legislature? Is there a fact-finding done by an objective third party?
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
No,
Mr. Piemar, sorry.
I'm just trying to find out, so you're going to do this analysis, the department's going to do this analysis, and then I'm just trying to make sure I understand this, that, and then a determination, so in other words, a recommendation is going to be made. And I'm trying to find out, because it does not say here in the bill that then, let's say a recommendation is made, it doesn't. There's no process here that says that a legislator could bring that back to the legislature if they disagreed with the department's recommendation.
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Piemar, there's nothing that prohibits anybody from bringing legislation to their legislator to seek legislative changes. So there's nothing in this bill that changes the legislative process. What this bill does is it empowers the Commissioner of Health to engage in a fact-finding mission, shall we say, of what's going on out in the community where it's impacted.
Perhaps you should inquire of staff, Mr. Piemar. Representative Benelli, sorry. Ms. Benelli, do you want to comment about that, about the discussion that we're, who has the final say in this matter that's being discussed?
Well, my understanding, Mr. Chair, is that the findings will be reported back to the committees, but not to the legislature, pursuant to processes that have been established in other statutes that require, copies to be distributed to the to the legislative reference library and so on. But this would just provide four copies to the chairs of the committees.
Representative Piemar.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Cederson, I was correct then in the way that the bill is crafted. It does not come back to the legislature; it comes to the chairs of the two committees. And that help in the Senate and the House.
Representative Severson?
That's correct.
I understand it's the intention at least to give good data to
as opposed to it simply being a... That's the point is research and that there's some substance to the recommendation, I think. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So, did that solve your questions? Any more questions? Representative Tremba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, can they do this already?
Representative Severson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tremba, right now there is no avenue for the Department of Health to do this study because there is no funding for it. There's no opportunity for them to divert assets to address a request for an exemption to the moratorium. So there's really no avenue for someone to come to the table and say, this is what we want to do, and it becomes a political issue rather than what it needs to be as a research in the local local level.
Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that this bill as amended by Amendment 875 be recommended to pass and proceed to the floor. All members understand the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? This amendment's, the bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Bradley, I think you're up for these people, I think, are all here for the hospital bill, wouldn't they not?
Want that?
No.
Representative Bradley, whenever you're ready, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would. To get things started, I would like to move that House File 1681 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce.
And that motion is before us. Do you have some amendments that you, or what, how would
Madam
you like
Chair,
to proceed?
The next motion for me would be to move the delete all amendment, which is H1681DE3, and that would get the bill in a form that I believe the public is well aware and that the author would wish to start with.
And this is the amendment that was available to members on Thursday. So to put the bill in the shape the author has been working on, I would move the DE3 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley, there's an A-19 amendment. Would you like to move that?
Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I would like to sort of go through kind of an update to the members of the bill and then come back to a couple amendments that the author would like to have heard by the committee. But first, I would like to review to put everything in proper context.
Yes, please do so, Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if I may refer you to a single sheet, one-sided, that was just passed out, I'll use that as a way to help put the delete all in context. We've had 9 hours of, I think, really excellent hearing, a lot of terrific discussion in this committee already, and I don't want to take us all back through that. What I want to do is sort of bridge from where we were in those discussions to some of the key modifications that we made in the delete all. The protocols that I used in the sheet that you have are this. I tried to describe, at least in bullet forms, for each of the articles, the major components in the delete all. Those pieces that you see, the number that you see that are listed in sort of an italicized form, are the either new or changed sections in the delete all as compared to the original House File 1681. Those that are in the regular font are those that were previously in the bill and remain unchanged. There's one more sort of approach that I've used, and that is I do have a few, I think about three or four, where I have in a more bold font, and those are modifications that I'm prepared to discuss today. Since the lead all has been out, we've had some, I think, practical feedback from people. Some of them are in the form of amendments that we were able to get in under the timetable, and some of them we were not able to, and it'll be at the discretion of the chair and this committee whether you want to deal with it now or if you want to wait until we move on to other committees. With that, let me take you through and particularly highlight those things that have changed that we've added. Article 1 continues to be the article on consumer empowerment. One of the additions that we made is sort of on the theme for those of us in government to try to be models of implementing the things that we're proposing. And in the current bill, it specifically tells the Department of Employee Relations to bring to the table and, as a matter of fact, to deliver as one of the options for our labor negotiations in the future, one of the options to be an HSA-based. I will come back to an amendment later that modifies that. I've been reminded that I may have gone a little far in terms of labor negotiations, and I respect that. So what you will see in the proposal that I'll make to the committee modifies that and simply asks the Department of Employee Relations to prepare an option and to bring it to the table for negotiations, but leaves it to those negotiation processes as far as what actually goes into the final product. The second item is in the spirit of the consumer empowerment, it is very important for consumers to be able to get cost quality information, and this specific element speaks to requiring providers to provide what we call the range of payment, not asking providers to expose their specific contracts with specific health plans, but at least if the consumer does ask for what's the cost of a procedure, that the health plan, the healthcare provider would share with the consumer the range of payments that that provider would get. And then number three is an item brought to us in sort of the pharmacy. In our explanation of benefits, sometimes missed are some of the consumer opportunities to understand the dynamics of our prescription drugs. We typically only see it as a point of how much our copayment is. This would say that explanation of benefits ought to include what the copayment is, what the payment back to pharmacies are, and the various elements. In the current bill, it speaks to this being provided quarterly, and both the health plans and the pharmacies agree that it would be a lot more useful to consumers if this were done on a claim-by-claim basis. I would tell you, members, I think we know the spirit of what we want to do. We haven't quite figured out the mechanics, so what we'll probably do is today I'll just tell you about this, and to make this thing work properly is probably going to happen as we move to the Commerce Committee. Those are the changes in Article 1. Article 2, the additions added there to give us a little bit more specifics on best practices, again, sort of in the theme of if we're going to promote it, then let's do it ourselves. So the first one of those is to ask the Health Department to work with the various stakeholders to identify, in this case, somewhat arbitrarily, to pick five. I think when you start getting too far along, you get into some controversy, but I think we all know that there's well-established procedures for things like diabetes, heart treatment, asthma, and some others. So we've said let's take the ones that are known and let's work with the stakeholders to make sure that we improve the actual application of those best practices, and that's what that particular item is. On the second item is one that did not change from previous times. This is the extending adverse reporting, as it says there, the surgical centers, but if you read the language in the original bill, in fact, it goes beyond just surgical centers. And I think it's been rightfully pointed out to me in the last few days that you're talking about getting down to perhaps a single provider kind of office, and maybe that's just going too far. So what I'm going to propose is that we back that off, we apply it probably where the biggest outside of hospital risk is, and that's surgical centers, and if we learn more in the future, maybe we can extend it further. But that's what that change to this means, is change it to specifically and only surgical centers. And then the additional item in that Article 2 and best practices is in the case of us being the payer for our public assisted health care, to ask the Department of Human Services to adopt 3 out of maybe those 5 guidelines that we would pilot, we would focus, and we would be pressing as a payer for those for better practices. At Article 3, the change there goes to a couple of areas. On the third item there is in the case of punitive damages, we've proposed that not change the limit, but punitive damages would be deposited instead into the MCHA high-risk pool fund. And then number 5 is an item where working with the hospitals, I think there's been probably some well-founded criticism to applying the government hospital rules to nonprofit hospitals in that the overall absolute limit can readily be below what the actual economic costs are. We're removing those provisions, which means then that nonprofit hospitals would have the same limits that is applied in the rest of the bill, the non-economic, but what we would propose to change, you'll see in the specific language, is that we remove any application of punitive damages for the nonprofit hospitals. Article 4 deals with government mandates, and if you notice under 2 there, we have a couple of modifications that are part of the delete all. The first of those is rather than at the 3% limit of the market, which, by the way, I don't think has changed it to 10%, will change who actually would enter. But the feeling is that if we really want to improve competition, we're not going to attract many people if they get in and then bump into that 3% limit. So what we're suggesting here is that we raise that to 10%. And then also that we remove for this specific kind of application the requirement on loss ratios. There are no changes in Article 5 and Article 6. These are fairly small items, at least the first one of those, number 3, just allows the health plans to communicate to their consumers with electronic transmission if the consumer agrees to that. Number 4 is a, you might call it a deeming provision, which would say that health plans, if they are accredited by a nationally recognized accrediting body, that would be good standing for any state requirements. And members, those are all of the provisions that have changed, as I said. I mean, certainly during discussion, if there's questions on any of those sections, I'd certainly be happy to revisit those. But I thought it would be most important to try to bridge with the members where we were and where we're going. So I'll pause, but I do have a couple of amendments after we pause, if there's any questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Huntley has a question.
Madam Chair and Representative Bradley, a couple of questions first. Did I hear you say that you are removing the nonprofit hospital liability portion that would cap them at $300,000 for total expenses, so that the only thing that the hospital's nonprofit you're talking about now will be the $250,000 pain and suffering?
Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that's correct, but let me be fair with you. As I think I also indicated, that the one difference between the standard and the rest of the bill and this provision would be that we would not allow punitive damages against the nonprofit hospitals. Otherwise, you are correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Representative Bradley, in Article 4, I missed what you said about loss ratios do not apply.
Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, what we're saying, if checking the language, when you know, in this pilot, we are providing various relief from existing mandates, and the other mandate that we've added now is the notion of loss ratios.
So Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, so loss ratios is back in the, will be back in the bill after you do your further amendments. No.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Huntley, no, I'm sorry. The loss ratios would not apply to this group, and that was not in the provisions before.
Okay, I thought it was.
And
Representative Bradley.
I'm sorry, that one is in there. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, not to confuse, because, for example, we were just talking about the nonprofit. I hope that my nomenclature here is clear. The delete all as it currently exists does not have that change. I have an amendment that I'll be presenting to the committee to do what we were just talking about. So that is not yet in the delete all. But in a moment when we get to it, I do have an amendment that would do what I just discussed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Huntley.
Just a matter of procedure. I would suggest that we let the author make his amendments first and then get the bill the way he would like it. And then at that time, if it's appropriate, I will move to, when it comes time to vote, to do each article separately and vote on each article. So divide the bill into the articles and vote.
And we can
to be honest, there are some I'd like to vote for and some I'd like to vote against.
We can have a discussion about that, Representative Huntley. Representative Bradley, do you have other amendments you'd like to move to get the bill
sure,
in the shape you want?
And I welcome the spirit of what Representative Huntley said. Keeping in mind, I understand that these are sort of not necessarily automatics. They are certainly still open for debate, but it would help to get the bill in the shape that the author proposed. One of them is fairly straightforward in the case of Amendment 8. But let's go ahead and do. Let's see, I'll get the first one. Let me move then, Madam Chair and members, Amendment A-19.
Representative Bradley moves A-19. Representative Bradley, please explain that.
Madam Chair, this was not previously on the list. This is what I told you we've learned since the bill has been out, and through this weekend I've been working with the Department of Employee Relations. So I think for it to be heard, I want to be clear with members. It may violate the time limits. I think our general protocol has been as long as members are okay with the amendment. That doesn't mean you have to support the idea later on. But I would wish to point that out to members. But what the amendment would do is change it from, in the current language, a requirement to have an HSA option as one of the final outcomes of our labor negotiations, to having an HSA option being required to be presented as a part of our labor negotiations. It doesn't change sort of the intent of having it around. It just, I think, puts it in a posture that's more proper for our labor negotiations. And that's the only intent of this amendment. Department of Employee Relations helped bring this to us, and my intent is to at least make that section adhere to proper law and PELRA.
Let me just ask committee members, are there any objection to this late amendment? Seeing none. Is there any discussion on this amendment? Representative Ebler.
Just a comment on the whole thing, Madam Chair, and I hope that we can get something out of this committee and that can pass in the law that encourages HSAs. And the state has a lot of employees, and if we can somehow take the lead in this thing, this is where some of the savings are to be found. You empower people and get these HSAs going where they own the money. And I hope, and this amendment moves it along, so I hope we support it.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Senator Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just didn't point out to me, I failed to point out that I believe this changes something about the adverse reporting as well. And I did mention it to members, but I think lines, let me get this right, and the staff can help me on this. I believe lines 12 through 14 are the sections that change the adverse reporting and limits it strictly to surgical centers. Is that correct? Okay, my apologies to members. I missed that point, but that is in this amendment as well.
Representative Bradley, would that be then on page 7?
Yes.
Okay.
And that would be lines 12 through 14 of this amendment.
Okay, to that point, is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the Bradley amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley, did you have another amendment?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. Before I do, though, let me also point out something that with my approach in defining the bill, it wasn't probably clear because it's not shown. One of the other changes that we made from the original House File 1681 in the delete all is we removed a section that Representative Huntley actually brought to our attention, I think, more than once, and that is that we had a provision which would have repealed the current MSA provision, which requires payment levels to be at the same level for a consumer as the high deductible part of the plan. And so I've taken that out. This is in deference to some good advice, I think, from Representative Huntley. As a matter of fact, I think Representative Huntley has an amendment later on to make that even better, to apply the same notion to the health savings accounts, which I will at that time also support. That's just a kind of a background I forgot to cover. Now, Madam Chair and members, the next amendment I'd like to move is Amendment A-10.
Representative Bradley moves the A-10 amendment. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is what I described before, members, to make it clear. What this amendment does in 9-8 is to remove the current language from the original, from the delete all, that would have made nonprofits hospitals on the same level as far as medical malpractice as government hospitals. So we're striking that, and which makes them, by default, hospitals subject to the same limits that are in the rest of the bill. And then on lines 4 through 7, what we're doing there is removing the nonprofit hospitals from the punitive damages altogether, that the punitive damages would not apply to nonprofit hospitals. I believe I described it before, but this is the amendment of what I described before.
Any discussion?
No.
See no discussion? All those in favor of the A-10 amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Does this conclude your amendments, Representative Bradley?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. So I think we're ready to move to member amendments.
Madam Chair?
Representative Abler.
Thanks. I have three, and I think half people came because of two of mine, so we can just let them get done so they can go home.
Representative Abler.
I all my friends in the audience there. I had a great idea that didn't go as well as I thought on two of these. There's been some discussion about kickbacks and false claims. And I spent some time actually with one of the authors of one of the bills, Representative Johnson, last week, looking at find ways to kind of shrink down the scope. As introduced, these two topics I think were a little broad and brought in far too many things, especially from a provider point of view. I thought they were trying to kill an ant with a sledgehammer. So I actually, my sledgehammer is only half as big, and it's still too big of a hammer. I don't know that there's a big problem with these two areas. And the best I could do is not sufficient to proceed with, but my concern was especially like dentists and that want to give a mug to a preferred client at Christmas time because they've been referring clients, or my insurance agent gives me a pie if I refer somebody to his practice, and I don't get many pies, but at least he gives out these pies, and those involve health insurance sometimes, and that would actually be a felony under the bill as introduced, which seemed a little harsh to me. And apparently there's already a safe harbor language, and so I'd like to announce to the world that these two, Amendment A7-1 and A8-1, will not be offered. So you can put those in your pile. I heard from some good people, and I, above all, do no harm, Madam Chair, so it's my desire there. But, Madam Chair, if I may, I'd like to offer Amendment A4. And with the following caveat, I'm not convinced this is the very best way to handle best practices. But I, in the same way, talking about HSAs with the potential that they offer, and with best practices and the work, as if someone can figure out what a best practice is, we should try to export that, not in form of statutory best practices or in form of some government group saying you can and can't do this, but in terms of people who are sincerely interested in finding the best way to do something and doing more of that in a way that has better outcomes. There's been a great deal of politics in healthcare over the last century or two or longer about who can do what and what's published and what doesn't get published. And on a policy level, it seems like you wouldn't do it that way, but that's how it's become. And I can't fix all that, but my thought was here is if at least if the boards, as a starter language, would convene some groups, they may do groups. If they would or would not, they could decide. They could incur costs or not. If they wanted to, they could publish whatever they found out. If they found something, they should publish it. But whatever they could come up with on at least a few topics, I think it would push the discussion. And if I would hope we could adopt this today, knowing it's a work in progress, and that at least it'll provoke some discussion about what is the best way to promote people doing the best way to serve a person with a back injury or a headache or asthma or, you know, a knee problem, and try to eventually get some cross-professional dialogue going. That's the intention of this amendment, Madam Chair, and so I would hope members can support that.
Abler offers the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion about that amendment? Representative Bradley, did you have any comments, or
thank
you, no one else?
I think Representative Abler characterizes it very well. This is probably one of the most difficult parts. It is a notion which it seems like we all embrace, the notion of we ought to do better in the practice of medicine and health care. But trying to do it in a way that is really workable as we evolve in identifying those things that legitimately are is difficult, very difficult. I've ranged all the way from very specific. I think our original version had the Board of Medical Practice, and that time we were sort of focused on one area, to open it wide up entirely, and then back again. And I would recommend a vote for this amendment. I think people can make their own decisions on it. I think it's probably a good way to sort of keep this debate and discussion alive, and I hope we evolve. It's very important, in my own opinion, that we do this right, and it's been very helpful to have a lot of good discussions, and there's good organizations out there doing things already, but I don't think it would hurt for us to give a nudge, and this is one way to give a nudge, and it'll come back to us in the Finance Committee, because I suspect that these boards will probably need a little bit of money. Now, it's generally paid for out of their own fees, so if they believe in it, that's fine, but it may also even incur some additional expense. But I'm going to vote for it, and I would urge members to do as well if they wish.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, I also support this, and granted it may change as the bill goes along, but this is, I think, a key part of the bill, and this is a good amendment, even though it might change as we go along.
Seeing no other discussion points, all those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
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 Those opposed, motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. On to other amendments. Who would like to offer the next amendment? Otherwise, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A13 amendment. And this is, Madam Chair, members, is the one that Representative Bradley referred to. It simply says that those people that are on medical savings accounts or HRAs, whatever they're called, would get in the first part of it, before they get to their deductible, their high-end deductible, they've got a certain amount of cash in these funds, and they get to spend it however they see fit. But what this says, if they do go to a healthcare provider and they're in the out-of-cash part of the savings account, that they will get the same discount from the provider that they would get if they were in using the high-end deductible. So it gives the individual the ability to have some clout in the marketplace with the large group he's in, and rather than just going in as an individual and paying the high charge, which practically no one pays. So this just makes sure that he gets the same discount that he would get after he had exhausted his out-of-pocket expenses.
Okay, are there any comments, discussion? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's the logic, the eminent logic of Representative Huntley, or if it's the fact that since his room is right next to mine and he has some sort of subliminal music playing through the night, but whatever it is, I support the amendment.
Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A13 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Huntley, you have another amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, this one is...
you know, they can't all go that route.
Not as controversial as the previous one. in the... what section is this now?
I don't know. Is it the
A11 amendment?
A11 amendment, okay. That refers to page 22, so... Article 7, Section 1.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, what this section of the bill says that if we increase eligibilities for some health care programs, that and if those programs don't pay the full cost to the hospitals or doctors that are providing it, like medical assistance or GAMC, or Minnesota Care, that the bill requires that we at least get a fiscal note on this so we know what cost shifting we're dumping onto the healthcare system. What my amendment does is simply say if we decrease eligibility in any program. In other words, kick people off of insurance, that we also get a fiscal note as to how much shifting of costs that's going to go to hospitals who are then going to, and required by law, to give care to anybody who walks into the emergency room. And so that if it seems to me, if it's fair to ask for a fiscal note of when we expand a program, it ought to be fair to ask for a fiscal note when we contract the program. Because they both can do the same thing, which is put the uncompensated or lower than normal compensation on the healthcare system. And I think if we're going to pass bills going in either direction, we ought to know what the impact is on the healthcare system. So I move A11.
Representative Huntley moves the A11 amendment. Any discussion? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, either one out of two is not bad, or your music quit in the wrong time, Representative Huntley. Actually, there's a bit of merit. Certainly, I'm concerned about uncompensated care. I don't mean to diminish that at all, but I would argue against the amendment. I know that in the case of the cost shifting that we saw some pretty good mathematical analysis about that relationship. This analysis, it seems to me, is incomplete. I've not seen anybody that is able to make those kind of correlation in what amounts to a very complicated world called uncompensated care, because there are so many other variables, including direct funding that we make to community clinics, including DISH, disproportionate share, and so forth. I'm worried about the shifting, but I don't think that we can make a very good correlation, so I think it would be impractical to ask for a fiscal note on it. So I would speak against the amendment.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll give one example. Mr. Tim Sullivan, who was on Minnesota Care, and we cut his benefits to a $5,000 yearly cap. It turns out that he came down with cancer and needs $12,500 a year, a month in chemotherapy. Well, we cut him off after about 2 weeks then. And the problem is that Mr. Sullivan didn't go away. He's still there. He's still getting treated. And somebody's going to pay. And what this amendment does is... I just received a note that said he just died. What actually happened to Mr. Sullivan is that he got put on medical assistance after he spent down, and he was losing the value of his farm since we put a lien on his farm of about $12,000 a month, which was what his wife was going to try to live on, the value of the farm. She was going to sell the farm. I just think that it's important that when we cut people off of insurance or reduce their benefits, that we understand that they're not going to go away. They're still going to get care in emergency rooms or in hospitals, or they're still going to get their chemotherapy. It's just that somebody else is going to pay. And I think we ought to get a fiscal note that tells us who's going to pay and what they're going to pay.
Any further discussion? Representative Paymar.
I'll ask for a roll call, please.
Roll call has been requested. Seeing no further discussion, are you the clerk? The clerk will take the roll.
Boudreau.
No.
Abler.
No.
Bradley.
No.
Dempsey. Finstead.
No.
Huntley.
Yes.
Norness.
No.
Opatz. Otremba. Paymar.
Aye.
Howell.
No.
Samuelson.
No.
Smith.
No.
Soderstrom.
No.
Howe.
Yes.
Walker. Wilkin.
No.
The vote being 10 opposed and 4 in the affirmative, the amendment does not prevail. Representative Paymar, do you have an amendment, or Representative Opatz is not here?
Madam Chair, if you will allow us to vote separately on each amendment, or excuse me, each article, then his amendment would not be necessary.
Okay, well, I know that's something you mentioned earlier, Representative Huntley. I'm going to leave that, let members comment on that, and I think we could, we can ask that that be a motion.
Okay, Madam Chair, I would move that when we vote, we separate the bill into each article and vote on each article separately.
Okay. Representative Huntley has a motion before us about dividing the bill into separate articles and voting on them individually. And Representative Huntley, to that point, I think I understand the purpose for that, and I understand how that might be helpful in getting portions of it passed, but it also is somewhat problematic to those who are continually working on the bill, and this is the first stop. This is the first step. As you know, the bill has other committees to see, and so I'm just going to advise members against that, but I do hope that if you have some comments or discussion, you may bring those forward at this point. Representative Wilkin.
Just a point of parliamentary procedure. Can you divide by each article, or can you only divide in two? I honestly don't know.
It's my understanding that the Bradley motion to have the bill before us, that has the bill before us, can be divided, but I am not sure. That's a good point, whether it can be divided so many times. I think we had this discussion, if I recall, a few years ago about can we divide a bill or can we divide an amendment. And if I recall, you can divide an amendment, but dividing the bill is really the questionable part here. So do any of our House research folks have any guidance on this? I wouldn't answer that either if I were you. At this point, I'm going to take the authority to say that the bill cannot be divided. And if I'm proven wrong on that, maybe we should just have a vote to assure that it's not going to be divided. To the Huntley motion regarding the bill being divided today, and we'll settle that for today, I would ask members to say aye, that you support the Huntley motion, and nay if you oppose the Huntley motion. At this point, all those in favor of the Huntley motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not pass. And we will find out the conclusion of that question. I think it is an important question to answer, but for today, we're not going to be dividing the bill. Representative Huntley, did you have, or Representative Paymar?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I would move Amendment A-12 then.
Representative Paymar moves the A-12 amendment, which deletes Article 3.
Yes.
And
I'd
wants
like to speak to that briefly, Madam Chair. I think that this this article is grossly unfair. This deals with medical malpractice and puts caps on the amount of rewards that someone could receive. And I think we had some lengthy discussion last week about this article of the bill, and it was brought up that Minnesota had the lowest malpractice premiums for in the country, that the Congressional Budget Office found that limits on medical malpractice awards have no effect on overall health care spending. So the question is why are we doing this? And I think it's important, regardless of the testimony by one of the doctors that was here last week, that what we're trying to get at when you have awards for medical malpractice is that you really are trying to ensure that institutions are trying to achieve the optimum in care. And I just bring it back as a related kind of issue, but back in 1982, there was a woman who was in Torrington, Connecticut, who was beaten and stabbed by her husband. And The court found and awarded her $2.1 million because they said that the police department in Torrington, Connecticut, didn't act properly to protect her. This woman survived. She was severely disfigured, but she survived. But this case was extremely important in the United States because after that was in 1982, almost every police department in this country changed their policies and procedures on responding to domestic violence cases. It sometimes takes a huge award to shake the foundations of an institution to change their practices. And above that, I think it's important when we think about the problems with medical problems. I mean, we had testimony from a doctor who basically said something to the effect like going into a hospital and having something happen in surgery that is like winning the lottery. In other words, stuff happens. Well, stuff does happen, but I think it's incumbent upon this legislature to ensure that a jury of our peers has an opportunity to award what's proper if such an error occurs. We have to ask the question, how much is a disfigurement worth? How much was the loss to the woman in St. Paul or Minneapolis, I can't remember where she was from, who had two of her breasts removed by mistake? How much should the jury award the St. Paul man, George Bidwell, who just recently was operated on, and they operated on the wrong side of his brain, and he developed seizures and other medical problems after undergoing the surgery. The jury awarded him an award of $850,000, yet we as a body want to cap that and say that the jury was wrong. The judge always has the ability to throw out a decision in terms of financial reward. I don't think it's up to this legislature to be setting caps. And coupled with the fact that it does nothing to lower medical costs, and we already have low malpractice premiums in the state, so I would urge that this committee support the A-12 amendment deleting Article 3.
Discussion, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, the bill, as I understand it now, with one of Representative Bradley's amendments. It does no longer restricts any restrictions on economic damages. Is that correct, Representative Bradley?
Representative Bradley,
Madam Chair,
clarify?
Representative Huntley, that's correct.
Okay, Madam Chair, that was not the case in the original bill. Despite what the Session Weekly said, it did cap economic damages at $300,000 for hospitals. And since half the docs in the state work for hospitals, in the Mayo Clinic, they all work for them. In my town, St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, all the docs work for the hospital. Conversely, those physicians that work at St. Luke's are independent. So you would have a different situation for malpractice between those two different groups within the city of Duluth, which didn't make sense. But Madam Chair, the reason Representative Paymar's amendment is worthwhile is that, number one, the purpose of this bill is to reduce health care costs. This part of the bill, Article 3, does not do that. And I'd like to read you something based on this is from the Congressional Budget Office in Washington. And they quote from the General Accounting Office in Washington. But their statement on health care costs of malpractice is because malpractice costs account for less than 2% of spending, really it has no effect. And I could go on and read you another section. Some of the things about malpractice is said that, well, that causes doctors to have defensive medicine. And again, the Congressional Budget Office says, conversely, if doctors face less than the full cost of their negligence because they are insulated by liability insurance or because malpractice is unrecognized or undercompensated, then they may have too little incentive to avoid risky practices. For all of those reasons, it is not clear whether the tying of control malpractice, of trying to control malpractice by means of liability, improves economic efficiency or reduces it. So basically, they're saying it really, the data isn't out there, and the indication is it would have very little cost on the on healthcare. They also say that there's three factors that have affected increasing malpractice rates. One is some increase in the awards. But number two is that all the insurance companies ultimately are paying for 9/11. And they've got to come up with the bucks because they're reinsured, and somebody's paying for that, and it's what happens is your insurance rates go up. And the second is, the third one rather, is that they've lost a lot of money in the stock market. Insurance companies take most of the reserves, put them in the stock market, and we all know how the stock market's gone, and they have lost. So there's only one of the three reasons relates to this, and the Congressional Budget Office says it will have no effect on overall spending. Senator Paymar has talked about this, but you know, when a doctor comes in here and says that filing malpractice is like winning at the lottery, you ought to talk to the individual who had the wrong side of his head operated on and ask him if he won the lottery. And you ought to ask the woman that had both breasts removed by mistake whether she won the lottery. And you ought to ask Mr. Williams, whose wife, because of a mistake in a hospital, is now in a vegetative state. And you ought to ask him if he won the lottery. And why is it that we think we can set the awards and that we're smarter than a group of peers of that person to settle that argument in a court of law where it ought to be settled? They're the ones that get the information about the family. They're the ones that can look and ask questions. We don't get that opportunity. We're going to treat everybody the same and say it's $250,000, period. What do we know about those people? We certainly don't know enough to make that decision, and that's why we have juries of peers make those tough decisions and decide what the non-economic damages ought to be, if there are any. So I think we should vote for Representative Paymar's amendment and remove this from the bill.
Further discussion, Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And all due respect to Representative Paymar and Representative Huntley, I look at this medical malpractice reform as being about patient safety and trying to prevent medical errors. And I think that's what we should be about. And if we are really trying to push toward that, then we want to make sure that a review of procedures and peer case review are encouraged rather than discouraged. And what we've got right now is a situation where the threat of malpractice and the threat of liabilities is making physicians, hospitals, staff, and all kinds of people in the medical profession fearful of reviewing procedures in an open and transparent way. It brings it all back behind closed doors where these things can't be discussed. For instance, in the medical profession for years and years, and we still have this problem, but it's gotten a lot better, where there used to be a lot of needle sticks, and we've cut that down simply because we sat down as professionals and decided what we needed to do to fix that. Now, it's very difficult to sit down as professionals and talk about things that bring us the medical profession a threat of liability suits, and so it just drives them behind closed doors. If we want to prevent patient medical errors and improve patient safety within the hospitals, then I think we need to make the procedure open and transparent. And I think that's one thing that we haven't talked about when it comes to medical malpractice reform. I believe that would help us move into that direction. And I would urge members to vote against this amendment.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we've heard lots of testimony. I think we spent a considerable time, so I'm not going to try to go through. But let me at least react to some of the things that were said. In the case, what I want to remind members, by the way, Mr. Williams, and that's a very, very compelling and very emotional case, but one of the reasons we made the change that we did was because of the reactions that people had about the limits on hospitals that would have had some bearing probably on that one. We do not have any cap. If you listen to Mr. Williams' testimony carefully, what you heard was a list of damages that were economic damages, and the care of his wife in this tragic case would not at all be capped in this current bill. It may be arguments about, but in the health affairs in January was a report that indicated that the states, and there are many states that do have caps, that on average their premiums for medical malpractice are 17.1% lower than the other states. I know in one of the states recently that passed, they're seeing a 12% reduction. I think the emergency physicians brought to us a very compelling case as to what the consequences of medical malpractice explosions are, and I think we even heard something about that in OBGYN community. The case that was mentioned about the person who's operating on the wrong side of the head is certainly another one of those tragedies, but let's sort of review the facts. The fact is that the lion's share of that, most of it was economic damages. If you add the fact that we're not taking away non-economic, we're just limiting it to $250,000. A relatively small amount of that $850,000 would actually be affected. The final thing I would say, and there's different kinds of evidence, but I think we heard this again from the emergency physicians, but I've seen numbers that talk about the consequence of defensive medicine practices being in the U.S. in the range of $67 to $122 billion a year of impact, and that's another area that we're trying to do. I think that we've had some great testimonies probably on both sides of this, but I think the evidence continues to persuade me that I wish there was a silver bullet in terms of fixing health care costs. There isn't. It is a multidimensional problem, and I think as a part of it, we have to do something about the whole medical malpractice area as well as its corresponding effect, and that is defensive medicine.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just a process discussion, and I'll tell you why I'm going to be voting against the Paymar Amendment today. It's no secret that I have some concerns about this section of the bill, and it's no secret that I have taken pieces of legislation that need far more work and beg committee's indulgences to work through them and often found ways to resolve the issue. I have friends on both sides, and as Representative David said, I'm voting my friends today. But I think the better discussion site for this whole topic is in civil law. I think the arguments can be brought forward there for and against, and to proceed from there makes far more sense. I want to commend Representative Bradley for the movement he's shown on the hospital part, and I know he means well on this. We don't agree on every part of it, but he needs a chance to work through this and to give it a chance to properly bring all the people together to talk that are going to not talk if this should go out. And so for the sake of good process and good debate in this body, I'm going to be voting against the Paymar Amendment and any amendments that would change this section.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, just to respond to Representative Bradley, his comment about the Bidwell situation, the man who was wrong side of the brain was operated on, Mr. Bidwell under Representative Bradley's bill would lose $250,000 of that judgment. And I'd ask for a roll call vote on this amendment.
I'm sorry, Representative Paymar, was that a question?
No, it was a request.
I'm sorry, please repeat.
I was just making a request for a roll call. Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Any further discussion, members? Representative Wilkin.
I'm sure. I want to address that last statement because the breakdown that I've seen does not say he'd lose $250,000. At best, there's $200,000 that if you lumped it all into non-economic damages, which is not clear from the breakdown that has been in reports that I've seen, that would be the absolute most. In all likelihood, it would be much less than that, but I don't know that was broken down in the judgment. So if you want to see the breakdown, it was in the media. $400,000 for future medical expenses, $250,000 for pain and suffering, which matched up with the cap, actually. Then the jury awarded $200,000 for past wages lost, which would not be capped, pain, disability, disfigurement, emotional distress, some of which are capped. but it's not clear what the breakdown of that is, just so members know.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, we'll have a roll call on the PAMAR 812 amendment.
Boudreau?
No.
Abler?
No.
Bradley?
No.
Dempsey?
No.
Finstead?
No.
Huntley?
Yes.
Nornis?
No.
Opatz? Otremba?
Yes.
Kamar?
Yes.
Howell?
No.
Samuelson?
No.
Smith?
Yes.
Soderstrom?
No.
Howell?
Yes.
Walker? Wilkin?
No.
There being 5 votes for and 10 votes against, the amendment does not the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Finstead, are you willing to offer your amendment right now? That would be the HRD amendment. It says potential amendment 9. Representative Finstead.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would at this time move the HRD A9 amendment. And
please explain the amendment, Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment is pretty self-explanatory. It adds clarifying language to Article 3, Section 1, Paragraph A, and essentially it says that that paragraph does not apply if the best practices guidelines authorizes or recommends denial of treatment, food, or fluids necessary to sustain life on the basis of the patient's age or expected length of life, or the patient's present or predicted disability, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life.
Is there any discussion on, I'll call it, the HRD amendment? No discussion? All those in favor of the HRD Finstead amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is Representative Opatz still here? No.
He's
Representative Paymar, please.
He has another bill up, Madam Chair.
Members, we're near the end of our committee time, and most of the other issues are kind of in a category, and I would suggest at this point that we would recess and continue those amendments at half an hour after session. I don't know if there's any comments. Representative Smith, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, I have 11 amendments in the packet, and they're identified with the same number except a variable letter at the end, A04-0866A through L, with the exception, I think, of F. 11 amendments that I have informed the author and your committee administrator that I would like these kept with the bill and moved to the Committee on Civil Law. I believe it'll be there next week, I hope, and that those amendments would receive discussion and votes on their merit at that time, and not take up further time of this committee today. And as much as the bulk of those amendments contain issues, I think that civil law should be seeing.
So, Representative Smith, you're just asking that these amendments go along with the bill and be discussed at a future time. And Representative Bradley, would you like to comment on that?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that position. And I can assure Representative Smith, not only did I assure him, of course, and I think it's pretty obvious that the Civil Law Committee has the prerogative to take up any issues anyway, but I certainly encourage that. Plus, I've offered to Representative Smith and to any of the advocates for these to visit. I'm hoping that in some respects some of these issues, which I'm willing to debate and discuss with people, and perhaps we can reach some compromises, and I've made that offer as well between now and next week when it's heard in civil law.
Very good.
Members, thank you, Representative Smith, for that consideration. There is one amendment that is left that has not been addressed. Representative Opatz, do you wish to offer this at this time? Because then we will meet a half hour after session. Otherwise, we will probably just... Representative Opatz.
My apologies. I had a bill up in higher education. And,
I understand.
Frequently, so I apologize for that. And because I've missed what I'm sure was a good debate about the tort reform in the bill, I'll withhold from offering the amendment. Thank
okay.
You.
Representative Opatz, you can present that at a future date. The bill is going to a couple other spots.
Any comments right now, members? Representative Huntley.
Do you want to adjourn now, or is that, or well, are we going to keep going? I have at least 10, 15 minutes to talk here.
Representative Huntley, perhaps then we will meet a half hour after session if you feel that you'd like to make some comments. But at this point, I have no further amendments to take up unless Representative Opatz reconsiders, and that is his option. So we will meet a half hour after session, but before we recess, Representative Abler, your
Thank
comment.
You. And also, Madam Chair, I neglected to make it earlier. For those who care about emergency health powers and the act that's under consideration that will sunset this June 30th, the subcommittee will be taking that up on the 23rd, which is a week from today, half an hour after session. There'll be a notice published, but I wanted to let you all know so you could find your calendar. And what we're looking for there are your specific thoughts and comments about how to make it better. Is it working? I would like specific page and line suggestions about how to make it be less onerous, more effective, looking at all of Chapter 12. And our index case will be SARS. And so if SARS would hit here, what would we do about it? Toronto has some good experiences. So I think given a good kind of tragic kinds of experiences, but there's now some experience about why we might need that. And so that'll be our discussion about that, Madam Chair. So
Thank you. And members, you may keep all of your papers right where they are. There's no other committee coming in. We'll just come right back here. And we are in recess until a half an hour after session. We have a quorum, members, so the Health and Human Service Policy Committee will reconvene. I think we were at the point, members, of just having a discussion. And so if there are comments or discussion, Representative Huntley, would you like to make some statements?
What if I didn't raise my hand, Madam Chair?
Well, then we'd just be out of here, wouldn't we?
Madam Chair and Representative Bradley, I'm going to go through each article and briefly say what I like and don't like about the different sections of the bill. And the first section deals with health savings accounts, Article 1. And you brought some people in to testify at, a couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, from the Olmsted Clinic. And the kind of health savings account that they had, I think, was fine. And basically, it was a family. They had a $2,000 deductible health policy, and the company gave them $1,000 to do whatever they wanted with the first $2,000 of expenses. So the most they'd be out of pocket was $1,000 in that plan. And my big concern about health savings accounts is that we don't transfer the expense from healthy people to sick people. Obviously, health savings accounts are great if you're healthy. You never reach the deductible, and so you never have any out-of-pocket expenses. But if, for instance, instead of like the Olmsted Clinic, somebody set up an HSA that had a $5,000 deductible and still only put $1,000 in the pot for the employee to work with, that person, if he was a chronic diabetic, would be spending $4,000 every year out of his pocket. And healthy people would be spending nothing out of their pocket. I'm willing to go with $1,000 out of pocket because most of those people have incomes where, while it's painful, they can afford it. But if you get up to the point where you're having $3,000 or $4,000 out of pocket, I think that just puts the burden on sick people rather than healthy people, which is not what insurance is supposed to do. The best part of the bill is the best practices section, Article 2, and I'll just talk about two things. If you don't think best practices can save money, and this is one part of the bill that if it works, will save money. There was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine on antihypertensive drugs. Okay, and they compared three different classes, diuretics, ACE inhibitors, and calcium channel blockers. And the diuretics are all from the 50s and 60s, and they're practically for free. I mean, they're all off of patent. We didn't have real good chemistry. Those are free. This study published in the New England Journal of Medicine found out that, forget about cost to start with, just look at what is better for the patients. And for 80% of the patients, diuretics were better than the other two diuretics alone. And if you want to know the cost savings, in America we spend $15.5 billion on antihypertensive drugs. And we're, according to that study, are wasting two-thirds of that money because of the cheaper price of diuretics. So if healthcare practitioners followed what ought to be best practices, in that case, the country would be saving about $10 billion a year. And the patient's health would be better for it. The next two things, another New England Journal of Medicine article on quality of health care delivered to adults in the United States, and this is from June last year. Now, I'll just read one section. Again, this has to do with drugs. But it says, only 45% of persons presenting with a myocardial infarction receive beta blockers, which reduce the risk of death by 13% during the first week of treatment and by 23% over the long term. So only 45% are getting a drug that costs maybe a buck a pill. Why is that? It would save 23% of the lives. Docs aren't, the system isn't giving those people the drugs they ought to have. Read on here, only 61% of the participants with a myocardial infarction who were appropriate candidates for aspirin therapy received aspirin, which has been shown in randomized trials to reduce the risk of death from vascular disease by 15%, to reduce the risk of non-fatal myocardial infarction by 30%, and to reduce the risk of non-fatal stroke by 40%. So here's a group of people who had myocardial infarctions. Only 61% are getting aspirin that ought to be getting aspirin. And what does aspirin cost? And it would reduce the death rate by 15%, 30%, or 40%, depending on which outcome you're looking at. So between those two drugs and the antihypertensive drug is something that would save vast amounts of money if we could get the healthcare system to deliver the kind of care that they know works. There's nothing new. This isn't rocket science. We've got the data. And this bill is the first step, I think, in the state trying to get the healthcare system to deliver the kind of care it ought to deliver. And if it did, people's health would be better, and it would save us money. So I love this part of the bill. We discussed malpractice insurance, and I don't love that part of the bill, but it certainly cut my comments short when the chairman put that amendment in there to get rid of the cap on economic damages. But again, just remember, folks, that in the state of Minnesota, we spend $21.5 billion, that's with a B, dollars on health care, and the payouts for malpractice are $19 million, a tenth of a percent. So I don't think whatever we do there is going to improve the cost of health care. The mandate sections, what we're talking about is two mandates. The two that save money are covering pregnancy and covering mental illness. That's where the big bucks are in mandates. And if we allow insurance companies to sell coverage that does not include pregnancy, first of all, if the company's bigger than 15 employees, they'll violate federal law. Federal law requires pregnancy coverage for every employee if the company is 15 or bigger. So we're only going to be dealing with a 0 to 1 to 15 employees. What we will set up is a discriminatory workplace. If women have a choice of jobs and they're of childbearing age, where do you think they're going to go? Are they going to go to a company that doesn't cover pregnancy, or are they going to go to a company that does offer pregnancy? Or conversely, the employers may discriminate against women and not hire them. They want to keep their rates low. They want to keep their employees happy.
Article 5 is the administrative reform. In fact, all of it I agree with. I just wonder why we didn't include in there radiation oncology facilities. If it's good for everything else, it ought to be good for radiation oncology facilities. Remove the reporting requirements. Article 6, for-profit HMOs is the main part of that section. In the past, I have not been opposed to helping the out-of-state insurance companies that want to come into the state and giving them certain breaks compared to the big companies in, or the companies in Minnesota that have a chunk of the marketplace. And I'm really not concerned that an out-of-state insurance company is going to come into Minnesota and bring an HMO in. And if you look at Prudential Insurance, tried for years to get into Minnesota, could never pull it off because they couldn't compete in this state. And Prudential has a annual revenues greater than the gross domestic product of Norway. And they couldn't come into, they couldn't make it in this state because they couldn't compete. The cost of entry were too large. The real danger for for-profit HMOs in this state is that Medica, Blue Cross Blue Shield, or Group Health, although probably not Group Health, will decide to go for-profit, switch from being not-for-profit and go to for-profit. That would be a huge change in the state if one of those did that, and that's why I oppose this section of the bill. If you look nationally, all the studies will tell you that for-profit HMOs, the quality is not as good, and that the costs are generally higher. The last one is the cost-shifting report, and I support anything that gives us information about cost-shifting, and so there's two sections of that article that I strongly support, the mandating that we not pass legislation rather that doesn't fund that deficit is Chairman Bradley might be able to convince me that that was a good idea too. But so that's my my summation of the bill. A couple of things in here are very good. A couple of things will reduce costs and improve quality. But overall, because of the malpractice and the mandate release and the for-profit HMOs, I guess I don't support the bill.
Are there any other comments or questions from the other members of the committee? Representative Bradley, did you have anything to add? I see no other comments.
There weren't any that I would, but just with respect if there's any other members that do.
I don't see anyone, okay. So you know, if you want to comment before you renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kramer.
I just have a question for Representative Bradley before he proceeds. And that deals with an amendment that we passed that I wished, in retrospect now, I would have voted against. But this whole, it was the amendment A-19 that dealt with health savings accounts and talked about during collective bargaining negotiations that the doer had to offer the option of health savings accounts. Was that? And I just, the question is whether you had any discussions with anyone from AFSCME or MAPE or any of the other bargaining units in the state of Minnesota, because I understand that they were not supportive of that language.
Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, Representative Haymar, I did not hear specifically from AFSCME or any of the other bargaining units, but I think when Commissioner Lieberman was talking to me, he was, I think, in his best attempts trying to represent what he felt would be their reactions. But in fairness, I did not. I believe, now, I've not heard of anybody since, but keep in mind what we changed is pretty fundamental. What we changed it is to ask Doer to put together a proposal that would be brought to the bargaining table. It may or may not, through the labor negotiation process, actually get to be offered in a package. But this all we're asking them to do is to simply prepare an HSA-based product to get to the bargaining table, and then the normal process takes care of itself. And I don't see why that would be objectionable to anybody.
Representative Pamela.
Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, the way I understand it, and I haven't talked with any labor folks directly, but that they were concerned about that was essentially interfering with the collective bargaining process. But I don't know if anybody's here from labor. So, but anyway, I just wanted to raise that issue as a concern.
Representative Bradley, do you have any further comments? Otherwise, I think the language is you know, I think it's just allowing that option. I don't know. But I think those discussions will continue in, you know, the following, as committees meet to hear on the bill. So.
Certainly, Madam Chair, and if there are any, I would certainly welcome discussion. It was our best shot on a fairly short notice to try to take care of that, but if people still have concerns, I'm open to listening to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
The language does say the commissioner must propose.
The commissioner, and Representative Paymar, that's right, the commissioner must propose that the state make available at least one plan. So it doesn't require that anyone accept that plan. It's just allowing an option for all people, even those who are state employees. So, I mean, I don't think it's, I think it's permissive, and that's what it, I think is Representative Bradley's intent. Representative Bradley, would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I would, but before I do, maybe just quick, I have no intentions other than I just wanted Representative Huntley to know that the tape recorder was on and we'll select only those parts that I like for continuing. But I appreciate the comments, and I'm not going to try to respond. I mean, I think we've all had our discussion. We have spent now upwards of 11-plus hours, I think, on this topic. I hope, though, that regardless of what our opinions are, that our constituents recognize this as we see how important this issue is. We may differ in the solution, but I think we all agree, again, on the importance of continuing to work. And through this process, at least I know I've become better informed on issues, and I think we've made some modifications trying to do that. We've got a long way to go yet. I hope that this legislative session will exit with some important and specific and concrete actions. We can no longer afford to let this debate be a high-level, theoretical, abstract kind of debate. It has to be that we really present some things. And as I've been telling many groups, it's also not a spectator sport. This is a sport that people have got to get involved in. It isn't just legislative. Thankfully, I think we are seeing some really great efforts in the private sector. And I applaud those. And I mean, I've actually had somebody this morning hand me another indication of their strategy, and I said, well, I could probably tell you right now that I don't think it's enough, because the kind of examples that Representative Huntley stated in best practices to me are something we can no longer tolerate for whatever the reasons, dollars and cents, human impact, those kinds of things. And I absolutely believe that it's not because of any maliciousness. It's not because physicians or healthcare practitioners don't want to do better. It's just a matter of the way the system works and all kinds of other things that sort of impede the process. And I think on all levels, I hope that we are completely impatient in making progress. And I do want to thank the committee. I know you've all invested a lot of time in this. Regardless of what we've done, I think to the committee and to the public who's come forward to us to help us debate this important topic, I'm very grateful. And Madam Chair, with that, I renew my motion that House File 1681, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Commerce.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. And members, I think our business is completed for today, so the committee is adjourned.